Welcome to Recalculating Small Business. Like its award-winning book, Recalculating is dedicated to small business in America. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins.
Our next guest is Brian Karamsad. He's VP of Research at LendingTree, of which Compare Cards is a part. His company has just released the results of a 1,000-person survey that reveals some interesting insights into how Americans approach their small businesses and side gigs. Brian, welcome to the program. Tell us a little bit about the survey, where people can get it, and a little bit about yourself.
Well, CompareCards.com wanted to get a sense of how much folks who are in the gig economy understand the role that business credit cards can play and what benefits and drawbacks that they have. Since the gig economy is growing so fast, it's really growing in leaps and bounds at this point. And I think some estimates put it at 34% or more of our workforce. And there are projections that that could increase to 43% as we get into the next decade. And at that trend, it could be well over half shortly after that. So, it's really important to understand where folks in the gig economy fall in their perceptions, understand if there are areas that they don't quite fully understand in the way that established small business owners might have experience with.
I'd like to jump in there real quick and ask a question about your statistics. There's got to be some reason why there's such explosive growth in the gig economy. I mean, you're by your own projections, 50% of the workforce we'll have some kind of a side gig. What's fundamentally changing?
Well, I think part of what's fundamentally changed is not just the internet, but mobile adoption and rapid mobile data. You look at a lot of these side gig type things, and the poster child for it is they call them ride sharing services, which is a misnomer, right? In reality, they're ride hiring services. You're hiring someone to drive you around. And the ability of rapid mobile data to enable someone to sit at home in their living room and accept an offer to drive someone to a doctor's appointment when they happen to have a one-hour window of free time is really a function of technology. And that's really enabled more people to utilize their time to generate income when they wouldn't otherwise. And they can do it without the constraints, paperwork, bureaucracy of finding a full-time job and getting involved that way.
You said in your survey results that many want to ditch their 9-to-5 jobs. Most survey respondents, 58%, with side gigs wants to turn them into a full-time career. So they're looking for full-time wages working out of their homes or whatever they're trying to do. So they're trying to grow a side gig business into a full-time business. And
exactly. I mean, I think there's an ambition on the part of people who are doing side gigs that they can make a go of it for themselves. I mean, just like any traditional entrepreneur would have. And let's be honest, the concept of someone doing something on their off hours is not new. Many successful entrepreneurs have started their businesses on nights and weekends, some less scrupulous ones at their desks at work. but that's not anything new. I would say, though, that the concept of being able to just download an app and establish yourself as someone who's ready to do side work for hire without having to acquire a customer base on your own, that's a relatively new thing. And I think it's made it a lot easier for people to entertain this notion. It lets them do a test drive of what a second career might look like. Whether it is driving Uber, we're actually surprised that most of the people who are doing the drive ride sharing as a side gig actually do want to move towards doing it full time. Our impression on that is most of the people who want to do that full time are already doing it, as opposed to people who are kind of dabbling with it with an aspiration of doing it full time. So that was a bit surprising that they are satisfied with it enough with it that they wanted to continue. But it's also a way for people to get freedom and independence they wouldn't have from a traditional desk job, right? You choose, with these platforms where customers are already matched for you, you choose when you want to fulfill that demand, and you can adapt yourself to that as opposed to having to keep yourself chained to the schedules of a traditional office. And I think that's very appealing to a lot of the people who are in this side gig economy today.
So do you think that this is this explosion that you're talking about, is it a relatively short-term phenomenon or something that's been growing over some period of time?
Well, it's interesting, right? You look at the statistics on business formation, and at least the ones from the census show that it really dropped off after 2008. A dramatic drop-off that never really has been fully explained. And when you look at some other stats, I think from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, it isn't quite so pronounced. And part of that just may be the people who are choosing to go it on their own or choose alternative means may not be registering their businesses the traditional way. They may not be going out and establishing a corporation because you don't need to in a lot of these situations, right? If you want to create goods and crafts on Etsy, you just enter your name and information. You don't have to register, or at least there isn't any explicit requirement to register on those platforms as a registered business. So you can do it as a sole proprietorship. Now, there are obviously, as you guys I'm sure have discussed with other guests, advantages to going through the registration process as your business evolves, particularly for protecting yourself from liability, and that may be something, frankly, that side gig people aren't well versed in and should be. But I think it's these technology platforms that deliver customers to you, as long as you're willing to fulfill that demand, are the real change here, and have enabled the side gigs to thrive.
I wonder if the economic situation that took place, I mean, I can give you my perspective as somebody who's been managing money for 40-some years, what happened after 2008, and I think it was a function of many people in America because of the depression of seeing their housing prices fall and their life savings of the value of their house go disappear, and having mortgages underwater, all of those things had a negative psychological impact on whether or not things were going to be prosperous or not. And I think that it took a long time. And then on top of that, with the federal government being so restrictive with thousands and thousands and thousands of new regulations, I think there was a diminishment in the will to want to try and succeed, and people just kind of got stuck. And then we've all seen the numbers, how income dropped during that period, household income dropped over $4,000. Maybe part of this gig economy is just a way to try and survive.
Yeah, it might be for some people, although we reached the point in the cycle where unemployment is rivaling levels where it was in the prior cycle, and the incomes that are being reported are getting close to those levels again as well. But certainly in the earlier stages of this of the financial crisis that we had and coming out of it, there was a lot of risk aversion, and certainly, frankly, I think there was a lot of distrust in the concept of relying on a corporation, right? Relying on a traditional job to make a living. And I think the concept of a side gig, which again may not show up in these statistics, may be a bit of insurance for people, right? A way to pad that potential loss of a paycheck that may come down the line so they don't lose the house this time around. I think that psyche is certainly part of what's made that attractive for people.
Yeah, I think the idea that the side gig gives you something else to fall back on, that
exactly,
you're not totally destitute and totally dependent on the government to send you a check. I don't know how long the side gig will continue, but I think that...
Well, yeah, and one of the things, right, is a good amount of it is on platforms that are funded by that are loss-making and funded by venture capital, right? And investors in high-risk profiles. Like Uber and Lyft are not in aggregate profitable. Now, you know, we hear things that in some markets they are on a unit basis. So there is a question, you know, when if investor appetite dries up for some of these side gig platforms like an Uber or Lyft or an Etsy, what then becomes of them if they have to pay more attention to profitability as a whole? Or do they scale enough that they do become viable as a whole as standalone enterprises without the level of outside capital infusion that they've required to get going? And so that, I think that's an open question about the viability of these things. But that said, it's never been easier for people to go out and at least start something on their own without leaving their house, right? With the internet, with platforms out there to create things and to conduct commerce. And, you know, certainly there are regulations out there, particularly in some of the more traditional businesses from pre-internet days. You know, those have become more challenging for a lot of folks, as you pointed out. But on the flip side, you know, for people who are a bit more nimble and looking for something that isn't necessarily the traditional set up a company and, you know, hire 50 people to do, you know, the work, there seem to be more opportunities than before, and part of it, again, enabled by the technologies out there. And people, I think, are mixing and matching their personal and business lives more than ever is kind of we see the way people are handling their credit cards.
So is the side gig another way of saying because I'm in my early 70s, when I was younger and I needed extra income in the household, I went out and got a part-time job. Is a side gig another way of having a part-time job?
Yeah, it's another way of having a part-time job, but I think without having to have the specific hours and management reporting of a part-time job, right? With a side gig, you don't have a direct manager. With a part-time job, you report to a boss. You have to deal with the consequences of that.
How much of this can the economy support?
You know, it's hard. I mean, it depends on how viable the value of the service being provided is, right? I don't know how much the cost of an Uber ride is being subsidized by venture capital, right? And how much of it is truly, you know, a true match of the price being delivered versus the cost to a driver, you know, in terms of what they receive as compensation and the cost of the platform making sense. That's the question, right? You know, is the cost to the consumer to take advantage of these side gig platforms a real cost, or is it something where it's being subsidized by free-flowing capital? And I think that's a question that has to be answered.
It's interesting when you look at it the way you're talking about it. Is this side gig business as a way for our economy to evolve going to be profitable?
Yeah, and we don't know, right?
We don't know. And the question is, how much of the side gig economy would you put on Uber and Lyft?
It's hard to say. You know, in terms of, you know, share of what I call media exposure, you know, it seems close to half. But that said, I would say there's just a huge amount of individual contractor. Individual contractor marketplaces out there, whether it's a place where if you want to write articles, you can go on platforms and register yourself as a writer. If you want to perform furniture assembly tasks, IKEA bought a business called TaskRabbit, and they are continuing to operate it, where basically individuals who have a spare hour can put their spare hours listed on the website, and then people like me who have a piece of furniture they need assembled can just go on there, pick someone who's available to them, and they come in, and for a preset price, we'll take care of it. So these matching platforms, I think, are much varied beyond just Uber and Lyft. And actually, the TaskRabbit example, you know, that's one where it wasn't profitable. They weren't continuing on their own. They got acquired by IKEA, though. And IKEA, right, was probably the biggest use case for that service. And I think they are able to see value in that as a way to make IKEA itself, which is a profitable enterprise, more viable to a bigger set of consumers who maybe were turned off by the fact that you have to assemble this furniture. Now they have an easier way to sell to people their furniture proposition.
But the, in the case of the IKEA example, they are expanding a service to their customer, but so doing it without adding to overhead an administrative expense to their company.
That's right. Yeah, these people are they are freelancers, independent contractors. Exactly right.
Do you see if this economy were to take another downturn, as some people are projecting, will that have an adverse impact on the gig economy?
Again, I think that what I view as the weak point of the gig economy is it's been talked about the last 5 years or so, is how much of it may be supported by risk capital. And so to the extent that risk capital dries up, what does that do? And I don't know the color of the next cycle will be, right? Every cycle seems to have a different flavor for it. The one in 2008-2009 was very much a banking and financial crisis. In the early 2000s, it was more of a risk capital issue and in a corporate profit recession, whereas the consumer businesses, the real estate markets, stayed relatively healthy. The early 90s, you know, that was fallout of the S&L crisis and cuts in defense spending that lingered for a while. So it changes with every downturn. It's hard to say. This one, I think we all ask questions about having interest rates at such a low rate for so long. Although I'm not an economist, but you know there are some alternative measures of the money supply that might indicate it's not as crazy as you might think just looking at the base interest rates. But again, every cycle turn has a different character to it.
Yeah, and I think that right now the expectations are hopefully high for positive numbers, but I think that my companions on Wall Street are saying that the kind of returns that we have seen since Mr. Trump came into office are going to get mitigated over the next 3 to 4 years, and we're going to move back towards the mean or lower than the mean, because I'm seeing people who are saying that 6% return would be a good return, and that has devastating impacts on lots of different businesses with a reduction to 6%. But it is interesting to see. We interview a lot of people, and clearly, one of the things that has fundamentally changed since Don and I started in the business a long time ago is the internet has become the distribution of choice for thousands of new businesses. We're amazed about the number of people. We just had a man on earlier today, who started a business 2 years ago, and he's got 50 people working for him, and he's got $200 million in sales, and on and on and on. So that the internet seems to be continued to grow and be places for which people can start businesses. And I think what you're suggesting is that may continue for some time, just unknown how long.
Yeah, I think that aspect of it, you know, the ability for someone with relatively little capital to create something useful, leveraging the internet, I don't think that changes. And that's one of the more untold stories, is how many people have built lives and businesses without the big sources of outside capital like these Ubers and Lyfts, people like your guest earlier today. My view is it's never been easier to do that because of what the technology the internet provides and the ability to source labor kind of in the spot market here, right, with these side gig type platforms. So that before you hire the 50 people, you can get bits of people's times to get your proof of concept up there, understand if the service you're providing really is a fit for the market and has potential to grow. And certainly it's been a challenge, you know, from the traditional bank lending side, but credit card issuers have certainly been very willing to extend credit to people just based on their personal income, to the extent that people want to use that as a way to finance ventures or at least finance things like your monthly cash flow. It does baffle me. I'm not an expert in those statistics. It does baffle me, the statistics you say that business formation has dropped sharply and hasn't recovered. Because when you hear stories like this, it feels like it's easier than ever to at least start something that could scale without the level of investment and cash up front than you used to.
I have a couple of questions. But first, Brian, what is, again, tell our listeners what LendingTree does.
Well, LendingTree is an online lending marketplace where consumers and business owners can compare rates on all kinds of lending and bank products. So whether it's mortgages, whether it's small business loans, small business credit cards, personal loans, even savings, checking deposit rates. And we do that via LendingTree.com and also LendingTree's subsidiary properties like CompareCards.com and DepositAccounts.com and MagnifyMoney.com.
But the follow-up on – thank you. The follow-up on what Dan – it seems to me that everything we're talking about are service-related, but we're not talking about building things. This country was based on raising crops and manufacturing. And if you believe the Wall Street Journal, the raising crops are now being concentrated. We're losing the ability to manufacture at a rapid rate, and all we're doing is servicing each other. Isn't that a prescription for disaster down the road?
It's a great question, right? You know, especially diversity of what we produce. You know, I will say you do see signs of, you know, kids in San Francisco are now doing startups where they're taking advantage of technology and 3D printing to create manufacturing processes more quickly than before and with less capital than before. So, for example, a small business owner can request a custom machine tool that they can now produce much more effectively with lower order sizes and requirements because they're using new 3D printer technology and they're reaching people on the internet. So it isn't entirely, a service-oriented, but clearly that has been the bias. And, I mean, that's been the bias since, you know, things – I don't have the numbers, but my sense is since the late 60s and early 70s when – I mean, the America kind of had the least manufacturing competition now just after World War II, right, when you had many of the former manufacturing giants trying to recover and rebuild, and we had an effective monopoly on that. And, you know, we've certainly grown as a country and diversified in other ways since, and, you know, our great benefit here is that Constitution that constantly lets us evolve and flows down to everything else that we have.
Well, if you look at it from the standpoint, do you leverage your business for example, if you have somebody that you're talking to about the gig economy and they're looking for something to do, do you market your Compare Cards and your other products to those same people?
We do. You know, for example, when it comes to the business credit card space, folks with side gigs actually are not terribly likely to use a business credit card. Only 27% of people with a side gig are using one, which is relatively low. And people forget that as a side gigger, even if you have little or no income, you can qualify for a business credit card. And the advantage there is, especially when it comes to tax time, you get to separate your business and personal expenses. So that is something we try to educate people about. The other benefit is as you grow your business with a business credit card, you're establishing a business credit history. So if you really truly do need to expand and kind of go more traditional route and end up needing a more traditional loan, you have something to fall back on in terms of a history, and so you're not getting socked with the very highest rates from lenders if you're going in cold. We do actively market to that community and try to educate folks about the benefits. Now, there are drawbacks, too. People have to remember, even though it looks like your personal credit card, doesn't have the same protections. The Card Act of 2009 does not apply to business credit cards. So if you, for example, were to charge a large equipment purchase on it and pay it off over time, the bank can't choose to change that interest rate in a way that it can't with a personal credit card without the same warning. So that's some place where small business owners need to pay attention. But I think there is a perception among them that because I'm not a traditional business, I don't qualify for business credit products or business reward type products. The reality is, at least on the credit card side, is you're often qualifying on your own income, whether that's your side gig or your own personal income, because you are actually personally guaranteeing that card yourself as opposed to with the business.
Dan, it's such a fascinating, but we have to call it a day. Brian,
okay.
We've been talking with Brian Karamzad. He's VP of Research at LendingTree. Brian, tell us again your website and how people can reach you.
If they want to see the study or they want to compare small business credit card options, they can go to comparecards.com and click on small business, and they'll see the latest offers and rates to compare.
Thank you so much for being with us. It's really been a pleasure.
I enjoyed talking to you all.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees, improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit cost. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's 2HSA.com.
Dan Perkins here from Recalculating.biz with your featured book. I want to tell you about a recent interview I had with Bob Bethel, a turnaround specialist with lots of success in small business. Bob's new book is Strengthen Your Business, Fail-Proof Strategies for Small Business. He tells us of his life successes and failures that have made him and his clients so successful. Over the years, Bob has brought 77 companies back from the brink and changed them into thriving, profitable businesses. His energy is amazing, and at 74, he proves that you can still have a great deal to give others if you just try. His suggestions are easy to understand and very helpful. One insight struck me was that most companies do not have a plan. The old Chinese proverb says, if you don't know where you're going, then any road will take you there, is true today. Bethel's book, Strengthen Your Business, can be found at Amazon.com or can be ordered at your local bookstore. This has been Dan Perkins with your Recalculating.biz featured book.
We're talking with Alan Cohen. Tell us about your company and your book.
Sure. The company I work for is Willis Towers Watson. We provide private exchanges through the name Via Benefits. Via Benefits is the private exchange we provide to companies, to organizations. Again, my name is Alan Cohen. I recently released a book that talks all about the private exchange revolution. The book is called The Employee Benefits and the New Healthcare Landscape, and it's available on Amazon.com.
So tell us about yourself and your company.
Sure thing. So I'm the head of product for a division of Willis Towers Watson, which is a global consulting and insurance brokerage firm. The division that I'm the head of product for is the benefits delivery and administration, and one of our kind of specialties is providing private exchanges to our clients, and this is it's a business that I actually had started about 10 years ago named Liaison that was purchased now 4 years ago by Willis Towers Watson. And we're, one of the leaders in providing private exchanges to companies in this country. You have over 1,000 clients. And in fact, if you look across all of the exchanges that we provide, in our division, it's over 1 million people have access to our exchanges.
So you're a broker, but you create an exchange for
yes. So we actually create the history of it is we were a private company that was actually not a broker that provided the technology and the services all around exchanges, and then we were acquired by at the time Towers Watson, which is a global consulting firm, and then we merged with Willis to become Willis Towers Watson. So now we are a global consulting firm and insurance brokerage that provides private exchanges to our clients and frankly also to clients of other brokers. Some of the largest brokers in the country, Gallagher is a good example. We power the technology behind their exchange as well.
Tell our listeners, what is a private exchange?
So a private exchange is a way that a company can kind of change their benefit strategy to offer employees a greater amount of choice and offer really kind of price transparency and a defined contribution approach to benefits. And so what that means is instead of, you know, picking one health plan, you know, one dental plan, one life insurance plan, what the company does is kind of allocate dollars to their employees. So it's, you know, we call it give them money and let them shop. They allocate money to their employees and then plug them into a store, which is, you know, exchange is just a funny word for a store, where there will be a wide variety of health plan offerings, dental offerings, life insurance, disability insurance, you know, different types of supplemental health offerings. And each employee, you know, with their family can now choose the benefits package that's right for them. So instead of, you know, the kind of the one size fits all approach, you know, to benefits where you have a very heterogeneous population of employees and they're kind of force fit into, you know, one health plan or the choice of a couple different health plans. You know, now each person can essentially craft their own benefits package using the money that their company has allocated to them. And so if we take that apart, you know, the allocation of the money is kind of the defined contribution part. And so the company now allocates those dollars to employees. They really feel like it's their money. The employee, or the, you know, the company offers a wide variety of choice. We think of it as meaningful choice to, you know, to each employee, with full price transparency. So now the employees really can see what the cost is of these different, you know, health insurance options, dental options, life insurance options, disability, et cetera. So they really understand the cost and the value of those plans. And then each employee gets kind of guidance to help them make the decisions that are right for them. You know, through an advanced technology system that offers, you know, robust decision support and a recommendation system and a lot of education and also, you know, live people on the phone to help them make their choices as well. And, you know, in a shopping experience that's, you know, a very kind of modern shopping experience that, you know, that's, you know, similar to what people are used to when they're shopping for other things, like, you know, shopping on Amazon or shopping, you know, or shopping for cars on cars.com, right? And so, mm-hmm. you know, what we get, you know, when you come through the other side of it, what you get is you get essentially a free market, you know, or a quasi-free market for benefits, where now people are making the choices that are right for them, spending what feels like their own money, making better choices, you know, for themselves and their family than a company is able to do, because, you know, a company can't consider every person's individual needs. And we also find that the companies, you know, save a substantial amount of money. And so, you know, what you get is, you know, financial savings for the company, you know, particularly a real cost control where they're able to budget exactly what their costs are and happier employees. You know, just some stats on that is that, you know, 94% of employees say that they're happy with the benefits they've chosen, and 75% of employees say that they're more likely to stay with their employer because of the marketplace that is offered to them. So, you know, in benefits, you know, the only reason why companies offer benefits is to attract and retain employees. And so here's a model where companies can, you know, cost efficiently attract and retain employees at a, you know, significantly higher level than they could, you know, with a standard benefit strategy.
Dan, I want to jump in here. Alan, you've written a very fine book, so we're going to give you a chance to plug it right now, and then I'm going to throw you a big curve.
Okay, sure thing. So, after we've, you know, after 10 years of doing this with, again, you know, thousands of companies and, you know, over a million people, we thought it was time to try to get, you know, all of our, you know, our knowledge down in a format that people can, you know, it can help them. And so, you know, a couple of years ago, decided to write a book about this and, you know, spent the last 2 years, frankly, doing a lot of work writing this book, that really describes, you know, in very great detail and frankly, with full transparency, you know, we talk about the benefits of an exchange. We talk about the disadvantages. We talk about companies, you know, what type of company is right for an exchange. And it really is, you know, and also, you know, we try to take an arm's length approach to it, where, you know, we are talking in general about the industry and about, you know, all the different organizations that are out there doing this, you know, not just obviously our organization. And, you know, so far the book has been really well received. You know, we had a book launch in Los Angeles, and, you know, number of people attended our launch discussions, and they had great, you know, it was just a great exchange of information we had out there.
Well, what's the title of the book?
The title of the book is Employee Benefits and the New Healthcare Landscape, and it's available on Amazon.com.
Okay. Now, I'll throw you the curve that just came across my desk, and you might have known about it. CVS just made a bid for Aetna.
Oh, really? I did. Okay, that, I try to keep pretty abreast of the news, and I had not heard that. So CVS Caremark is interesting. So CVS, I think when we think about CVS, we think about, you know, all those stores that we go to, right? But a really big part of their business, in fact, you know, arguably the more important part of their business, is their pharmacy benefit management, where they provide you know, pharmacy benefit management services to a large percentage of the, you know, the Fortune 500. And in fact, many companies that use kind of, you know, Aetna for their health plan are currently using, you know, CVS Caremark, you know, because CVS had purchased Caremark, which was the PBM, you know, for their pharmacy. So this is really kind of the combination. This is really interesting because, you know, there's been a lot of discussion in the industry about, you know, the loss that you get when you separate kind of the health plan from the pharmacy benefit management. And so, you know, a number of companies, you know, developed, you know, really good, you know, pharmacy management programs. Again, CVS Caremark is obviously one of them. Express Scripts is another, and Optum, which is a part of, you know, part of United Healthcare, is third. But one of the disadvantages of kind of separating, the pharmacy program from the health program is that they're really connected, right? And if you're trying to manage the cost of care and you're trying to manage healthcare, it's, you know, that creates a major seam. And so, you know, something like a CVS Caremark merger with Aetna would kind of reintegrate those pieces. And so it would now be under one roof. And so I could imagine that is one of the driving forces behind, you know, behind this, is kind of the reintegration of pharmacy, you know, pharmacy programs with, you know, with the health plan. And as I'm sure you know, you know, pharmacy costs are far and away the most significantly inflating costs that we have in healthcare today. In fact, the cost for the other types of services, like, you know, doctor's visits and surgery and outpatient surgery and hospitalization, have actually been trending very low. So the inflation rate's been very low, but the inflation rate for pharmacy has been quite high. And so that's becoming a concern for organizations. And again, one of the concerns is, if pharmacy is disconnected from the health plan, what type of kind of management or control can you provide across that continuum? And so I would suspect that a big part of the strategy behind this merger is that reintegration.
But don't you run into antitrust considerations?
Not in this case. I mean, because, you know, antitrust considerations would absolutely, in fact, we've seen the case as Aetna tried to buy Humana and as Anthem tried to buy Cigna. But in this case, this is Aetna is not really competing very much. A very large percentage of the large companies that Aetna serves, that United Healthcare serves, that Cigna serves, that Blue Cross serves, use a separate party for their PBM. So they use a third party PBM. And so this really is, you know, kind of that type of reintegration, which I wouldn't think would be seen as being, you know, heavily competitive, because it really is like, It's like, you know, General Motors buying Firestone, maybe, right? It's like a part of the car. That's important. I don't think this will have, you know, antitrust concerns, but nowadays everything, you know, it does. And so it's a reasonable, you know, it's certainly a reasonable question.
Do you think it will benefit small businesses?
No, I don't. I do not think it will. I think it's primarily for large businesses, and so I think that the PBM, the pharmacy benefit management organizations, really serve the self-insured clients, the large businesses. So I think this is primarily about large businesses, not small businesses. But that being said, you know, if the reintegration of the full health plan from, you know, kind of healthcare to the pharmacy services, if they're able to come up with, you know, better cost ways to control costs, that could filter down to the, to the smaller employers. But I would think this is more about large employers to start with.
Back to you, Dan.
Thank you. I've been listening to the conversation, and I'm curious about over the last 8 years, how has your business been affected by the implementation of Obamacare, and what will be the implication to your business should it go away?
So it's a great question, because I think there's a natural, it seems like there's a natural connection between, you know, public exchanges and private exchanges, and certainly anyone who's in the employee benefits world, you know, it seems like, you know, the ACA must have a major effect. The actual truth of the matter is it has not had a significant effect, except in a couple of different ways. The ACA is really primarily about helping individuals and the very smallest companies in our country afford health insurance and gain health insurance. And so if you think about the ACA, there's really, you know, you kind of cut it into two parts, right? You know, one part is the Medicaid expansion. The Medicaid expansion, you know, doesn't really affect, you know, company benefits at all. The second part is the, you know, the reform of the individual insurance market. And, you know, the dramatic reform of the individual insurance market, which, you know, to go away from, you know, medical underwriting, to have guaranteed issue, to have deductibles that are governed at a low level, to provide subsidies to people who are not Medicaid eligible, you know, to provide substantial subsidies so individuals can purchase health insurance. Again, that really is about individuals. It's not about companies, right? Why I say it does affect small companies, though, so the effect has been that we see less small employers nowadays offering benefits at all, right? Less small employers offering health insurance because people can get health insurance themselves. And so because health insurance is now available to everyone in this country on a medically underwritten basis, we're finding less and less small companies offering health insurance. And so, you know, because we did serve, you know, small employers in the past, that had been an effect. I mean, we had in the past worked with a number of chambers of commerce that, you know, that had hundreds and hundreds of small companies. You know, I'm talking about really small companies, like companies less than 10 employees. And that business has almost entirely gone away because, you know, if you have a company of three or four employees, everyone's just buying individual insurance now. And so it's changed the small group market. It's changed the individual market, which doesn't have a major effect on private exchanges. I do think there has been one overriding effect, is that first of all, the debate around the ACA, then the implementation of the ACA, and now the debate around the repeal or reform of the ACA has caused a lot of employers to kind of freeze and not make any decisions because they're concerned that the ambiguity on the policy front means that something is going to change in the near term. And so they are not that interested in making a major change if some policy decision is going to come down that is going to cause them to make a change again. So we've definitely seen, you know, companies less likely to make a change because of the ambiguity in D.C. That was absolutely true kind of during the run-up to the ACA. I think we had a couple years when people thought, okay, this is the new law of the land, and so things have gotten back to a stasis. But now you know, we've seen it happen all over again with the repeal and reform efforts, because companies are not sure what's going to happen. They are reticent to make any significant decisions, especially in an environment where healthcare costs have not been increasing at a very high rate, which I think is important to understand, is that, you know, for all the talking heads we get in Washington about the, you know, radical inflation of healthcare, the truth is over the last 5 years, from an employer perspective, from a, you know, corporate or group insurance perspective, this has been just about the lowest 5-year inflation we've had in 30 years. And so it's not a very inflationary environment now. You know, typical trend rates are 3 to 5%, which certainly is over CPI, but not really that much over kind of wage inflation. And so, you know, because the costs are not, you know, escalating at a very high rate, and because the ambiguity in Wall Street, you know, the ambiguity in Washington, a lot of companies are saying, let's just leave the things the way they are. And clearly, from a private exchange perspective, this is a big change. And so we see that with companies who say, this is really interesting, but I'm not sure if I'm ready for the change now, because who knows what's going to happen. And by the way, I just got a 3% renewal, so it's not a big deal.
So I think that the general public thinks that Obamacare affected corporations, big corporations, because anybody who was doing more than 40 hours of work had to come into this. And so people found their jobs cut to 25 hours or 24 and a half. And so there was obviously must be a misconception on the part of the consumer about the impact of Obamacare.
Is absolutely a misconception. The vast majority of companies have made no changes whatsoever because of the implementation of ACA.
And I noticed yesterday.
It's 35-hour rule. It's not 40. It's 35 hours. But yes, I mean, there certainly are some organizations that used to have part-timers who worked 35 hours and they were not offered benefits. There are some. But on a overall net basis, we're talking about 175 million people that have, you know, insurance from their company. Mm-hmm. On an overall basis, it has been de minimis, this change. And it's not to say it doesn't affect an individual person, right? Just because it doesn't affect millions of people doesn't mean that it could not be affected for one individual. One individual may have been working 35 hours a week and had their time cut down to 25 so that they wouldn't, hit the threshold of requiring benefits. And I understand that is difficult for that individual person, but on a overall basis, there has been very little effect. The major effect of the ACA for larger companies over 100 employees, has been reporting requirements that they never had before. And so there's a lot of reporting requirements. There's a lot of, you know, they've spent a lot of money on having to make, you know, having to produce pretty complicated reports that they have to send in every year. But as far as the overall effect, I mean, anyway, let's go down the list, right? You know, people say, well, how about all those, the new benefits, right? Well, look, the vast majority of companies already offered plans that were fully compliant already, right? You know, big companies didn't offer, you know, cut rate health plans that didn't cover hospitalization, didn't cover pregnancy. That stuff wasn't offered, right? They say, well, what about the fact that now companies more than 100 employees have to offer benefits? Well, 99% of companies already offered benefits, right? They already offered health insurance. And so, you know, the vast majority of companies, you know, had already offered health insurance, so that's not substantial. Well, what about the deductible change, right? You can't have more than a $6,500 deductible anymore. Again, it's de minimis the number of companies that actually had more than a $6,500 deductible before the ACA. It was almost unheard of. And so, the main effect of the ACA on large companies has been additional reporting requirements and some of the taxes. You know, some of the taxes increase the cost, for companies.
Well, what about for small companies? Alan, I have to tell you, I'm not with Dan, but he must be over there seething a little bit, because we have both been, if not angry at ACA, certainly not supporters of it. Why is it that so many people dislike the ACA?
Well, I mean, let's start with the fact that the ACA was supported by a single party, and the ACA was you know, another party did not want it. It doesn't matter which one did it, right? And in a country where half the people love what one party does and hates like poison what the other party does, and the other half is the opposite, you could pretty much guarantee that anything that is supported by one of the two parties is going to be hated by everyone who's in the other party. So let's start with that, you know, political psychology. And then look, Americans don't like to be told what to do. And so individual mandate, forcing people to buy health insurance, that you know, I can see how that kind of can rub people wrong, right? You know, we're about freedoms and free markets. And so, you know, that's a new requirement that we have. Now, that being said, 20 million people have health insurance and never had health insurance before. So that's a pretty substantial good. Small companies have absolutely been affected. As I said, small companies, you know, now, you know, their insurance has changed. You know, the costs have changed. Would the cost have changed any differently without the ACA? Who knows? Because, you know, we don't have a control in this experiment. A lot of small companies have now chosen not to offer health insurance, you know, because you can get it yourself. And by the way, you can get it yourself paid for by the government. I mean, imagine a small employer who, you know, who has a relatively low paid population, because, you know, these subsidies, you know, subsidies can go up to $90,000 of income. Right. And so we're not talking about, you know, $12 an hour employees here. You know, you could have a, you know, let's say a small company that has, you know, medium to low paid and lower paid employees. Well, if they stop offering health insurance, all those employees get virtually free health insurance from the government. And so a lot of them have stopped offering health insurance, because people can get, you know, for all intents and purposes, free health insurance from the government. But then the people of that small employer who do earn more than what, you know, the subsidy levels are, well, now they have to buy health insurance themselves. And we know the individual market has been challenged. You know, the individual market has, you know, there was expectation that more people, particularly more young people, would come into the individual market. That hasn't turned out to be the case. And so the individual market has been a challenging place for insurance companies to work, particularly because, you know, when insurance companies lose a lot of money and they then put in a rate increase to the state government, the state government declines it, right? Says you can't increase your rates. And the insurance company says, but I'm losing all this money. And they say, well, if you're not going to let me increase my rates, I'm going to leave the market, because this is what is, you know, because this is what I need to, you know, to, you know, to survive and be profitable. And so the individual insurance market is a place that has not stabilized.
Well, we just saw a report. I just saw it this morning that the estimated increase in premiums under Obamacare effective November 1st, they're going to go up 34%.
So my question would be, is that because the subsidies that were being provided have not been provided, are no longer being provided? And I would suspect that those subsidies, you know, the cost sharing subsidies are a big part of that 34%.
So when we hear the stories on the nightly news about premiums going up 30, 40, 50%, we're talking about people who are in individual plans out of Obamacare, and you're saying that the number of people that are, or at least I'm presuming you're saying that the number of people affected by that, you said 20 million people got insurance that didn't have it, but can they afford it? And with the price keeps going up, if the insurance companies can't raise the prices, they're pulling out, then I've got places in this country where there's only one option for Obamacare, and we may find by the end of this rate cycle that we have states with no providers in Obamacare.
Okay, let's talk about specifically that. So of the 20 million people who have gotten health insurance due to the ACA, the majority of those, something like 11 million of those, have got it through Medicaid expansion. Their costs are not going up one penny. That's Medicaid expansion. And so the Medicaid expansion, so of the 20 million, let's cut those 11 million right out, right? So 9 million people are buying insurance in the individual market. Of the 9 million people buying insurance in the individual market, a large percentage of those, probably something like 75% or more, are eligible for subsidies. Subsidies governor how much the cost can be for those individuals. Actually, the rate increases for anyone who has subsidies, the rate increase has no effect whatsoever. Because remember, the subsidies under the ACA are not a percentage of the premium. It doesn't say, well, whatever the premium is, we're going to pay 75% of it, right? Well, if that was the way the subsidies worked, then if the cost went up 30%, well, your 25%, your portion still goes up 30%, so you're paying more, right? That's not the way the subsidies work for the ACA. The way the subsidies work for the ACA is that it is a direct correlation to your family income. So if your family income is X, you cannot pay more than Y. Doesn't matter what the premium is. It doesn't matter if the premium goes up 1,000%. You still can't pay more than Y. Now, obviously, somebody else has to pay that bill. And the real big problem with the premium increases is not that people can't afford it. Now, I do understand that there are some people who are not subsidy eligible. I do understand there are people who don't want to pay that extra cost. But the big problem with the premium rates going up is that means the government is paying more and more. It's because the government pays everything over that amount. And so let's say the subsidy calculation is such that the individual cannot pay more than $200 a month. Well, if the plan costs $400 a month, that means the government pays $200, right? But if the plan costs $800 a month, it means the government now is paying $600. So the government's portion goes up dramatically, in fact, exponentially, as the cost goes up, because the ACA subsidies are governed at the income. And so, you know, the big problem, frankly, with rate increases is that it's going to, you know, bankrupt the government, right? We can't afford it. And so, you know, the solve for that is we need to have people in the pool that are healthier, because there's still, you know, 20 million people who don't have health insurance in this country who are still choosing not to buy health insurance, and they tend to be quite healthy. And so, you know, we need to figure out a way to get those people to buy health insurance so they can come into the pool. So although, again, and I understand that there are individual examples of people who are fully responsible for their insurance and who are absolutely seeing financial pain with these rate increases, the truth is that is not the majority of people. In fact, it's not even, you know, a large minority of people, because all the Medicaid, all the people covered under Medicaid have no cost whatsoever, and all the people who have subsidies, their cost is totally governed. On the point of of a single health plan per area, look, I wonder why, you know, we think it's so important to have more than one in a lot of ways. And I understand that if there's only one, they have some level of monopoly power. But the truth is they don't, because they are under very strict rules by each of the states. Because let's think about other things. We have one water provider. We have one cable provider. We have one electricity provider in most places. Frankly, in most places in this country, we have one provider of groceries. We have one grocery provider. So food, which is arguably more important than healthcare, in many parts of this country, especially rural locations, we essentially have one supermarket. But we don't then go crazy about, oh my God, we have one supermarket. And so I think we have to look at the effect. We can't say blanketly that having a single health plan provider is a universally bad thing. We have to look at what the actions of those single health care providers are. And because they are so restricted by the state governments, which frankly is a problem, the reason why we might have zero in some places is because the state governments are forcing the insurance companies to essentially run their business at a loss.
Alan, I hate to break in. It's been fascinating. But we've gone way past that time, and my engineer told me today that I've been allowing our guests to move to talk. But you're absolutely fascinating. Alan, we're talking with Alan Cohen. Tell us about your company and your book one more time.
Sure thing. Thank you very much for this. This has been a really interesting conversation. And so, you know, the company I work for is Willis Towers Watson. We provide private exchanges through the name Via Benefits. Via Benefits is the private exchange we provide to companies, to organizations. Again, my name is Alan Cohen. I recently released a book that talks all about the private exchange revolution. The book is called The Employee Benefits and the New Healthcare Landscape, and it's available on Amazon.com.
Alan, thank you so much for being with us. Wouldn't you agree, Dan?
Absolutely. I would encourage people to go to Amazon and get his book, because if it's as insightful as he was in a short period we had him on the show, it should be a great read.
Well, thank you very much. This has really been a pleasure. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you guys.
Thank you.
Talk to you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's episode was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz.